Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? It is Wednesday morning. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Man, you were up late last night, Riley, doing the big work on New York One, being the commentator, the guy, the go-to guy about the debates. What happened in those debates, my friend?
Well, I was one of four people that were there commenting on the debates. It was pretty much, as far as I was concerned, a push. And what I said on the air was the problem that all four of these Democrats have is that even people that don't like Mike Bloomberg, according to the latest polls, think he's going to win. And I mean, that's the crux of the problem. They're running against this aura of invincibility.
This is the New York mayoral debates, and Mike Bloomberg is like a cloud over this city, a rich cloud over this city, and all these guys, you say, just sort of act in relation to that.
Well, that's, I think, the great unspoken thing. I mean, they all talk bad about him to some extent or another, talk bad about his policies, but then the flip side of it was when they asked the four of them who was better, Bloomberg or Giuliani, three of them said Bloomberg.
Yeah, that's interesting. Bloomberg, to some people, is half a Democrat. Isn't that right?
Yeah. Well, he was a Democrat till he realized he couldn't win a Democratic primary.
So all the people that are running for mayor here are the Democratic candidates, our friends of our show, Fernando Ferrer.
Yes.
Yes, C. Virginia Field, Anthony Weiner, and Gifford Miller.
Anthony Weiner was an interesting story. Uh-huh. Anthony Weiner was taken to the emergency room in Brooklyn at 5 o'clock yesterday morning where he passed a kidney stone.
Wow. Man, I can't. It's like I can't handle hearing stuff anymore.
Well, you know, everybody thought he wasn't going to show.
I don't know what's happening to me, whether it's my age or whatever, but I see pictures of things. I hear about kidney stones or cancer and stuff. I get really squeamish and weird.
No, you know what it is? When I see someone younger than me passing a kidney stone, I figure my time is coming soon.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe you'll get lucky and not win that particular lottery.
Let's hope.
Yeah, this kidney stone, they just sound awful. I was on Opie and Anthony's show yesterday afternoon.
Did you get the curse?
No, what is the curse? What is that? What do you mean? Did I get the curse? Oh,
yeah.
Yes, I definitely did.
Oh, okay.
And I felt myself doing it. Yeah, oh, yeah, gratuitously doing it. Yeah, they don't even curse. You know, they know well enough to use it sparingly, but I, of course, started blathering on and putting the F word in every other word. But it was interesting because I didn't go there, you know, thinking that I would be confronted to talk about politics. I thought they would bring me on as a comic. I know Jim Norton for years. I know Opie. He comes down to the clubs a lot. And I went in there, and Dick Cavett, who's on our show later this morning, was on that show. Uh-huh. And he was running long. He'd been in there about an hour. They didn't want to let him out. And then Cavett took a slag at me, not knowing who I was, because Opie said, we got Maron coming on, Mark Maron coming on. And Cavett goes, screw him. Let me stay on. So he... So then I go in there, and Opie wanted me to do a couple bits, and I indulged him. He wanted to do a bit that he tried to paraphrase of mine, so I did it. I did the dance for him, and then bam, you know, that Norton and Anthony started, you know, coming down on me about racial profiling, you know, character, and just making these liberal caricatures, and it became this fairly, not a heated debate, but certainly an active discussion about what turned out to be the mischaracterization of liberals, this sort of blanket sort of stereotyping of liberals, which they're all guilty of, you know, certainly Norton and Anthony. But we actually were able to find some middle ground, and it was a pretty engaging conversation, I thought. I don't know how people responded to it, really, but it was kind of fun to see how another show works, because I haven't done another radio show in a long time like that. And those guys, they're there for like 5 hours, and they just sort of hang out, and it was pretty interesting.
Well, you know, typecasting liberals, not to take one aspect of what you just said, but I think typecasting liberals has become a very interesting parlor game among conservatives and among people in our business who think that you can make ratings. Hey, whether it's Opie and Anthony or that geek Michael Savage or whoever, there are people who make a living caricaturing everything that liberals do.
It's a bizarre thing, because in the course of that conversation with those guys, with Norton, I realized that there is no real way to characterize liberals. What they do is they use these stupid old stereotypes, you know, these sort of hippy-dippy reactionary stereotypes.
Birkenstein.
That really, you know, really, as you know, is just a little branch of the great liberal tree. What I started to realize in talking to them, that one of the problems we have and one of the strengths we have, and we've talked about this before, is our diversity. But there really is no way to lump characterize liberals or even progressive Democrats for that case. You know, they started going into, you know, the Second Amendment, talking about guns. There are plenty of people who are progressives or liberals or consider themselves Democrats who have no problem owning guns. There's just no way to create a stereotype. And what I started to find in talking to Norton and talking to Anthony is that even when you talk about comedy, some of the First Amendment freedoms that are afforded us as comics are sort of liberal causes, that our freedom to talk and our freedom to express the way we want to live our lives and to live the lives that we live are sort of, you know, part of liberal principles to respect that type of freedom. It is a constitutional right, but also just knowing that there are plenty of things that those guys, you know, on a sexual level and on certain levels that conservatives would find, you know, completely horrendous and abhorrent, are, you know, whether they know it or not. I told Jim, I said, you know, the core of who you are and what you believe in and what you want to live for is liberal.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, Opie and Anthony know good and well that they would not exist either on terrestrial radio, satellite radio, or any other kind of radio were it not for the struggles of, quote, liberals, quote, unquote.
Yeah,
from 30, 40 years ago in radio. Absolutely. These guys could not get away with what they get away with on a daily basis.
I think that's absolutely true. And it was always my idea, and even discussing it with Norton, that the history of comedy, what bothers me about guys like that is that you have to realize that from the late 50s all the way through the 70s, that the whole cultural tone of sexual permissiveness, of intellectual investigation, of hypocrisies, of just the tone of comedy was essentially liberal in its ideology. The entire tone of culture was, and that now that they've switched the tables on this and they've stilted the game the other way through a very concerted effort over 30 years, is you've got guys that really should be liberals, you know, talking like conservatives because it's easier. It's easier to be hateful. It's easier to be focused in that way, to be to stereotype. I was talking about talk radio because, you know, Anthony said, you know, they've tried liberal talk radio before and it hasn't worked in the past. And it was sort of an affront to me in the sense that, well, the truth of the matter is that when you got conservative radio, when you have a narrow-minded ideology, all you're doing, you're still whining, but you're doing it belligerently and it's manifesting itself as hate. And it's a lot more satisfying to a lot of people to listen to a guy. I go, that guy's an ass. I hate that guy. I hate that guy. As opposed to, hey, we need help. We need justice. We need change in this country. It's more satisfying to people that don't want to go deeper and understand why certain progressive values are important.
Well, yeah, and conservative talk radio. It kind of surprises me that Opie and Anthony would actually lump themselves in with these people.
I don't think they do, but I think that he is. I know Anthony, you know, it was, you know, once we started talking about profiling, which is ridiculous, and in just a few minutes, we'll talk about how bad it can get, and just, you know, around this new information about the guy who was shot in London, the Brazilian guy.
Menezes.
But you're surprised that they'd lump themselves in. I don't think they do as a show, but I think he believes a certain way.
Well, see, one of the things that people in this business, we'll talk a little bit out of school about the business we're in. People realize that if you're going to talk in this business, the money is in conservative radio. That's where the dough has gone because they are the ones that have the superstructure.
And the hate is there as well.
Oh, yeah.
The focused, weird, you know, sort of very, you know, narrow-minded anger. You know, and I started talking to them about that a lot of people who may not be conservative get excited to fight with liberals because there is a very narrow range of conservative talking points. And I don't know if they're really speaking their heart when they speak, when they argue, or just going, yeah, I won. You know, I don't know if people really thought about what the future means and what's supposed to happen in the future on a constitutional level and on a human values level and on a civil rights level, that they would really believe what they believe that they say.
Well, see, the thing is, they say I won every time that check goes into direct deposit.
That's right.
That's how they win.
All right, well, in just a few minutes, you'll get some very startling information about the Brazilian man that was shot and killed shortly after the, as a bombing suspect in the failed bombing in London, because it turns out that the police completely fabricated everything. It's 15 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Oh, Franken, nothing to lose. Makes you laugh at the troubling news. Sometimes I wonder if he's hitting the booze. Oh, Franken, king of the Jews.
Air America Radio.
20 past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition. Later in the show, Dick Cavett will be with us. Also later in the show, Michael McKean and Bob Balaban from Waiting for Guffman, Spinal Tap. You know these guys.
Wow, this is a great show we got.
It is. It certainly is. Here's some interesting and disturbing news. The official investigation into the killing of a Brazilian man. How do you pronounce his name, Riley?
His name is Jean-Charles de Menezes.
You know, after the attempted bombing in London reveals that the truth contradicts the police report. Evidence from video cameras proved that the police report was bunk. There was a shoot-to-kill policy, and this is what transpired. The lie.
Some serious lying went on here.
The lie was that he was a suspect. The truth, the police misidentified him. The lie, he was wearing a bulky jacket. The truth, he wasn't. The lie, he began running from officers and vaulted the turnstile. The truth, he walked onto the subway train and did not vault the turnstile. The lie, they pinned him down and shot him 5 times in the head. The truth, they pinned him down and shot him 7 times in the head, once in the shoulder, and 3 shots missed, but the casings were found. Talk about profiling gone way wrong.
Way wrong, and someone is going to pay for this. Someone is going to pay for having concocted this story. We've seen this happen in police departments in the United States where there's been some manifest wrongdoing, and they cobble together this kind of story. Well, you know, in an environment, and Mark, you made a very interesting point off the air, in an environment where you have a lot of cameras, it becomes, you know, in addition to terrorists and others not being able to hide, neither can the actions of police be totally hidden. And that's what happened here.
Yeah, and these were cameras. There's thousands of cameras in the tube system down there in London. And obviously cameras have worked this way before. But it is the other side of that, where you have a civil libertarian arguments about the need to get rid of cameras, that they're intrusive and that they infringe on people's personal freedoms and personal rights. Yet if it weren't for these cameras, they wouldn't have been able to identify the bombing suspects that were arrested and proven guilty. And they also wouldn't have been able to identify the fact that these cops covered up what they had done. Moving into another area, the Army Surgeon General said 30% of U.S. troops surveyed have developed stress-related mental health problems 3 to 4 months after coming home from Iraq, including anxiety, depression, nightmares, anger, inability to concentrate. You know, this is something that happens after wars. Like, you know, when soldiers return from Vietnam, a lot of them, you know, were scorned, they were shamed, and that along with the trauma of the war propelled many of them into lives of destitution, drugs, depression, crime. And this is really untreated post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't know if you know what that is, but post-traumatic stress disorder, these symptoms include nightmares, flashbacks, depression, estrangement, insomnia, and any of these symptoms can have their own repercussions. And doctors say that the disorder can occur, you know, months, even years after the events that brought it on, which is being involved in life-threatening experiences.
It's a scary thing, Mark, to contemplate that 25% of the homeless in America are veterans.
Yeah, and
are people who served their country.
And 47% of them are Vietnam vets, and there are about 300,000 homeless vets on any given night in this country. And the sad, scary thing that's happening now, folks, is that new vets from this war, from Iraq, are starting to show up in shelters feeling abandoned and untreated for their mental problems. And this is a big issue, and it's a big issue that's being dealt with in Massachusetts. Officials in Massachusetts are considering mandatory mental health screenings for National Guardsmen returning home from Iraq, and this is according to a mental health specialist. And there's a similar policy apparently already in place in New Hampshire. And the reason they have to put a policy in place around the National Guardsmen is that nationwide, mandatory mental health screenings only apply to service members in the Air Force, the Army, and the Marine Corps, and that usually only involves just answering a questionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this guy who's seeking this legislation is a Massachusetts Democratic representative, Martin T. Meehan of Lowell, and it would increase funding for veterans counseling and require more stringent testing for soldiers, because a lot of people don't understand. There's a stigma in this culture to psychological illness, and I think on top of that, Riley, there has to be a stigma to being a vet returning home and trying to integrate back into society. Can you imagine just sitting down with friends or just being at a bar and, you know, having seen what you've seen and been through what you've been through, and having people either going, wow, man, that's heavy, or people going, you were there, you know, screw that, man. You know, I mean, the kind of stuff that must be going on inside of a soldier returning home, you know, on top of the fact that there's a certain certain amount of shame involved in not keeping your head together just compounds the possibility of this post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and it's starting to manifest itself on a number of different fronts. For example, in Massachusetts, a Marine has been accused of firing a shotgun at a crowd of clubgoers after allegedly somebody threw an empty juice bottle through his bedroom window. He's being charged with armed assault with intent to murder.
And this guy was a guy that was named Marine of the Month last month by Marine Corps Times.
And he's a mortician.
Yeah, I mean, but talk about that. I mean, just not, this is a guy that you theoretically, you know, a mortician, and the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder are brought on by being in a life-threatening situation, but also, obviously, brought on by the fact that, you know, you're dealing with death every day and a kind of death that is very specific to combat, which could be the full range of horrendous possibilities that you see there. And then there was the other guy back in July, the end of July, that Army specialist who...
Matthew Seppi.
Yeah, he said he basically shot a couple of people in an alley on his way. He was carrying an assault weapon, an automatic rifle, semi-automatic rifle, on his way to get beer, and had some sort of confrontation with two people, a man and a woman, in an alley, and shot both of them. Said it was self-defense. I think they found a 9mm gun at the premises. It's still not clear, but first of all, just a couple of questions. You know, why are you bringing an assault rifle to go get beer?
Yeah.
You know, and why, you know, if this guy on the street that and he's having these reactions, he said that he had been trained in the military that in an ambush he should engage his targets and retreat. Now, if that's a quote, that I should engage my targets and retreat, and that's happening on the way to get beer because he's got an assault rifle, he slipped through the cracks.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, his attorney says that he should not be facing trial. He should be eligible for psychological treatment. The judge in the case gave attorneys 2 weeks to negotiate a possible plea deal. But again, this is a situation. A woman was killed. A man was seriously wounded. And there's questions as to whether or not this man had a legitimate reason to actually fire this weapon.
Yeah, it baffles me, first of all, that the guy up on the second floor, you know, he snapped and he went and shot a shotgun. Most people wouldn't go and get their shotgun and shoot at people in the street for any reason. Whether they threw a bottle in the window or whether they threw, you know, something crossed the line. And same with this other guy.
Yeah.
Because he crossed the line before he left the house. He had a rifle with him. And this is the kind of mental derangement and problems that guys come back with. And they're not being treated for it. It's a sad situation. When we come back in just a few minutes, do women run the world? 27 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. It's Wednesday morning. You know, you just saute it with a little olive oil and garlic and some white wine and parsley. That's what the guys at Marino's and Sons tell me. No matter what I buy, no matter what fish I get, I'm walking out. You know how to cook that, don't you? No,
yeah.
How? A little olive oil, white wine, garlic, and parsley. Just saute it up. Doesn't matter what it is. Doesn't matter.
Chicken.
What it is. Yeah. Yeah, chicken. Don't matter what it is. That's the general recipe. Folks, we're going to be up in Harlem this Friday. We're going to be up at Amy Ruth's in Harlem. We'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley, comedian Mike B, and best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis. We'll have free coffee. There's going to be great food there, I imagine. Tons of giveaways. It's Soul Food and Sedition this Friday morning at Amy Ruth's on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues from 6 to 9, as usual. And today's show, not only do we have Dick Cavett, not only do we have Michael McKean and Bob Balaban, you might know them from Spinal Tap, Waiting for Guffman, Best of Show, any number of very funny movies. And Dick Cavett, you know, from the old Dick Cavett Show. We have, this is for Dave Chappelle fans, my friends. His TV show may be dead, but Sony Entertainment is releasing Dave's uncensored Showtime special on DVD. And we're giving away copies twice today. And twice tomorrow, so stay tuned to win a copy of Dave Chappelle's For What It's Worth on DVD. Also, Cindy Sheehan has apparently we pronounce the name different. I said Cindy Crawford yesterday. Sometimes I said Cindy Sheen. Cindy Sheehan has asked supporters to start candlelight vigils in their communities to support her and call for an end to the war.
Yes.
So Move On is teaming up with True Majority and Democracy for America to host vigils for Cindy Sheehan tonight. There are already 23 vigils scheduled in New York City alone. Go to moveon.org to find out where one is near where you live. How would that be, folks?
Yeah.
Now let's get into this. Bush, President Bush, the puppet of the neocon death cult, makes history by being the only president in modern history, in recent history anyways, to not veto anything in 5 years. This isn't good because it calls into the question the idea of checks and balances. If the government is working properly, there would be vetoes because there would be an active debate going on. It is now that it is so tilted to one party that anything goes, and this is what the founding fathers were trying to protect us against, single party rule. What does it really imply, Riley, that he hasn't vetoed anything?
Well, it means, A, that the Republicans in Congress have shown startling amount of discipline up until now. One of the big breaks here is Bill Frist breaking ranks with Bush on stem cell research, but that hasn't happened yet. He has threatened to veto that, but it has not actually come before him. Right now, over the last 5 years, what has happened is the threat of a veto has been enough to get people in line behind the stuff that he's wanting.
But doesn't this mean, I mean, am I wrong? Because this is the nuance of political back and forth is something that's lost to me sometimes. But doesn't this mean to me, it means that they have no respect for bipartisanship, they have very little respect for the democratic process, that this is exactly what they want. They've effectively divided the country ideologically so that people don't even know what they're talking about, and when they argue politics just to win, like I talked about before.
Well, and what happens here is that the game of give and take between the Congress and the president, between the legislative branch and the executive branch, gets to be a game of inside baseball. It's all the same players. They're all part of the same party, so he doesn't need to use his veto that often.
Right, and on top of that, you've got this Supreme Court nominee that is turning out to be much more conservative ideologically than I'm certainly comfortable with. The Democrats have decided that unless there is an unexpected development in the weeks ahead, which is possible, right, Riley? Something could come up. We were talking about this yesterday.
Yes,
you never do know. But unless something really dramatic happens, that the Democrats are not going to fight the nomination. They're going to question him, yes. But they feel like he's most likely going to get the 70 votes that he needs to overrule filibuster. But I guess they can still delay the process. And I guess their plan is through the questioning of this nominee, they will elevate their core values about individual rights and sort of blankets over abortion and civil liberties and that kind of stuff.
See, the real indicator here about where the Democrats were going to go on John Roberts happened with the NARAL commercial.
Okay.
That was very critical of him with regard to his stand on choice and was pulled by NARAL after criticism from guess who? Democrats. And from guess where? In Congress. So what you have is a situation where once they started that criticism, that drumbeat of criticism, it was pretty much over.
Right.
The Democrats were not going to criticize a spot that was critical of this guy and then turn back around and seriously try to block his nomination. There are a lot of Democrats in Congress who believe that this is not the battle to fight. The battle over this particular Supreme Court nominee, they're looking at number two, the one who will be nominated when Rehnquist either steps down or dies, as being the crucial one.
But I'll tell you, I look at some of the information, 5,393 pages of memos of John Roberts, the Supreme Court nominee, were released Monday by the National Archives. And now these papers show Roberts as a young attorney working for Reagan, doing the party line. And I mean, whether or not he was working at the behest of Reagan or not, just the fact that he comes out against equal pay for women, he comes out, pro-school prayer in some context, he comes out, as a, certainly on some level, a potential big business stooge. His civil rights, his record on civil rights with the Reagan administration.
Tawdry.
Yeah, definitely. He may not be, just because of the fact that he's young and doesn't have a history as a judge, doesn't mean that, we can't make certain judgments about his ideology here. I mean, he seems like a real right-wing whack job.
But see, when he gets into the Senate confirmation process, you're going to see an amazing transformation of John Roberts. John Roberts is going to say, and I can tell you this right now because it's happened before.
Yeah.
He's going to say, look, those are my views 20 years ago. Remember that he, while working for George Bush the first, H.W. Bush, he came out with an administration position that said Roe v. Wade was unconstitutional, yet in 2003 he said it was, quote, the settled law of the land.
But when you fight like he fought for some of these issues for President George W. Bush and for President Reagan, you can't really cop out with the I was just following orders thing. This guy was trying to make his bones as a conservative ideologue.
Oh, yeah, but he's not going to say that he was just following orders. What he's going to say is, my views have changed.
Well, look at this. This one's important to lead into our next sort of, you know, we want to get some calls about this in light of a veteran BBC newscaster who is not snapped, but he's got a new show.
Oh, no, he's snapped.
All right, well, look at this. You know, John Roberts, as an assistant White House counsel in 1984, scoffed at the notion that men and women should earn equal pay in jobs of comparable importance, and he belittled three female Republican members of Congress who promoted that idea to the Reagan administration. The memo from Roberts was a response to a letter that the three women, one of whom was Olympia Snowe of Maine, now a U.S. senator, had sent to the administration. The women said that the concept of equal pay for equal work had not sufficiently boosted women's wages because women were not in many of the same fields as men. The three were promoting the notion of equal pay for different jobs of comparable value based on factors such as skills and responsibility. In his memo to then White House counsel Fred Fielding, John Roberts, a Supreme Court nominee, said the woman's letter, quote, contends that more is required because women still earn only 60 cents for every dollar earned by men, ignoring the factors that explain that apparent disparity, such as seniority, the fact that many women frequently leave the workforce for extended periods of time. I honestly find it troubling that three Republican representatives are so quick to embrace such a radical redistributive concept. Their slogan may as well be, from each according to his ability, to each according to her gender, end quote. So this is a guy that, you know, is not only willing to toe the party line, but he's got some attitude about it.
Well, see, what's interesting here, Mark, is that you're talking about the replacement for Sandra Day O'Connor, who was herself a champion of equal pay for equal work as far as women were concerned. So this is something that women's groups are going to have to sit and take a very long look at, and are going to have to pressure their legislators to ask him about in detail during the confirmation process.
And what are women's groups going to feel about this? Michael Bjork, I guess is his name, is a veteran BBC newscaster, and he's got a new show in England called Don't Get Me Started. He's making some waves. He said that life is now, quote, according to women's rules, unquote, that traditional male traits like reticence, stoicism, single-mindedness have been marginalized. He cited the decline of manual labor like industrial jobs and the lack of mining gigs and fewer jobs requiring physical strength. The new jobs require people skills and multitasking, which are women's strong suits, he claims. He said some changes are good, but, quote, what are men left with? All they are sperm donors, and most women aren't going to want an unemployable sperm donor loafing around and making the house untidy, end quote.
He's right about that. Most women are not going to want an unemployed guy sitting around the house dirty and stuff up.
Well, unless he's a musician and they like the band. But
he's going to be a star.
But, you know, this whole idea that women really run the world, I think is obviously, you know, maybe in an interpersonal way that may have some validity, but certainly in a cultural way, in an economic way, and in a power structure way is horse poop. So, you know, what I'm saying is, if you're a woman out there, do you think that you run the world? Do you think that you are controlling, you know, your men? Do you think that in some way you're controlling the country? I'd like to hear from you, because it's this sort of like, because this guy is obviously not coming from a feminist point of view. He's coming from a belittled man point of view, but there are some, you know, there are some men that, you know, honestly believe this in a practical sense, and then there, you know, other men that, you know, will split it up. But if you have any views about this, 866-303-2270 is the number. You know, we're also going to be giving away some Chappelle DVDs. I'd like to hear from some women and feel if you feel empowered and if you are actually running things. It's 44 past the hour. Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
You're listening to Morning Sedition. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Where you take everyone's suffering and turn it into gold.
That's 866-303-2270.
All right. What are you getting so steamed up about?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 49 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hey.
We're going to be taking some calls about, you know, do women run the world, according to this guy in England, this TV personality. They do, but I think that that is poop. You also are going to be giving away some Dave Chappelle DVDs in a contest. That's coming up shortly. But right now, sometimes it's hard to see what the headlines are saying. Thank God we got the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator to translate some of those headlines. So let's kick it up and do it. Here we go. From Newsday, nominee Roberts in 84 called equal pay for women radical. Nominee Roberts in 84 called equal pay for women radical. Translation, wife of Roberts called making him sleep on the couch inevitable. From Associated Press, study, pain neurons respond to garlic. Pain neurons respond to garlic. Translation, new pain relievers may also ward off vampires, which is good, especially if you live here in New York.
Yeah.
From Fox News, Germany warns U.S. against threatening Iran. Germany warns U.S. against threatening Iran. Translation, Berlin to Bush, Schock und Awe ist verboten. Wait, let's do another one. Germany warns U.S. against threatening Iran. New translation. Berlin to Bush, cut the scheiss.
No.
All right, so we got some the story that we are doing right now and that we're talking about right now is that we have a British broadcaster, Michael Bjork, I think is how you pronounce his name. He's got a new show out there called Don't Get Me Started. And he is basically saying that men just live according to women's rules, that they've taken over the workplace, that they've taken over everything, that because there's no more industrial jobs, men are left alone to just be sperm donators.
So wait a minute.
Donors.
I got to ask you something.
Does
this mean then that it was a woman's idea for this guy to say something this controversial just to promote his new show?
Well, you know, you've heard stuff like this before in the past. Stirring up the fires as a radical talk show host. Morton Downey used to do this kind of crap
Absolutely.
All the time. But you know, but it is something that men say. There is this old sort of wives' tale myth that sort of like women or who's wearing the pants, you know. Now I think you know in interpersonal relationships, you know, this is a different conversation, but certainly on a societal level, you know, I tend to believe that it's still not the truth.
Yeah.
Joe in Boulder, how are you? What's on your mind, dude?
Hey, Joe.
Oh, I just wanted to comment. I'm all for equal work for equal pay.
Mm-hmm.
But they need to remember the equal work part. You know, saying that I'm not physically capable of picking the trash up out of the trash can means that you're not physically capable of doing the job.
Okay, so you're saying you're for equal work for equal pay, but only if the gals can step up.
There you go.
Well, you know what? Here in New York, you have women who do sanitation work, you have women who do firework, and they have to generally pass the same kinds of physical tests as men.
All right, let's talk to Jeannie here in New Jersey. Jeannie, how are you?
Hey, Jeannie.
Hey, how are you? I'm trying to get this in before my bus comes because I'm on my way to New York City. So here's the deal. Yeah, there are policies in place that attempt to break through the glass ceiling, and in the workplace there have been some improvements, but the attitude is there. It permeates the air, and generally speaking, men just basically expect you to prove it because the assumption is that you're not up to par, you're not as good as they are in certain skill areas, and that's something you can't legislate attitude. It has to evolve.
So you're saying that, like the guy that just called, like Joe, that puts women already at a compromised situation right when they walk in a place.
Yeah, like, you know how the best way to say this is everything is relative to men.
Right.
So here's a perfect example. Cindy Sheehan is a woman, and who the hell would think that her message would not be political? She's saying, freaking get the troops out of Iraq. We never should have been there in the first place. But she's a woman, so she's relegated to this position as the grieving mother, which means she cannot do anything else. You either are the grieving mother and stay the grieving mother, and that's all you do, and God forbid you take a position in a participatory democracy, well, then you're no longer the grieving mother while you're political and you're a tool and you're a pawn. I bet you anything, if she was a man doing this, that wouldn't even be an issue. But the bottom line is, yeah, we're women, and we grieve, and we do have feminine kinds of characteristics, but we do other things at the same time.
That's absolutely right. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Well, I mean, the idea that these roles of being, you know, relegated to the kitchen, of being a mother, of being, you know, only nurturing, of being only capable of rearing children, that all of these roles are so ingrained and so culturally, you know, retarded at this point in time, given, you know, what women are capable of and what women are you know, are actually doing in the world, that that you have to break through those things, and this has always been the challenge. Carrie, listening in Massachusetts, how are you?
Hi.
Hi, guys. I love your show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I'm a feminist, and
a
real large majority of CEOs got a really high number of women in domestic violence marriages, something like a third to a half of women. We've got one quarter of women reporting being raped. We have sexual harassment everywhere. So, I mean, this is not the kind of country where women rule the world by any means.
That's right. Thanks, Carrie. She kind of broke up at the beginning. I think what she was saying was about 85% of CEOs are men. Half of all married women are in domestic violence situations or reported domestic violence situations with the men they are married to. So obviously it's certainly not a woman's world on that level.
No.
And James Brown said it a long time ago. It's a man's world. Deborah in Manhattan, how are you? Oh, I'm sorry, Ed in Nyack. What's going on, Ed?
Hey, Ed.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Listen, in New York City, if a female civil servant becomes pregnant, she is immediately assigned a desk job until such time as she either miscarries or delivers the baby. If a man gets into a similarly delicate situation, say you hurt your back at work or you hurt your back off the job, you have two choices. You can either go to work with that pain back, you can take your time, or you can be fired. There is no way that is a comparable.
But wait a minute! Don't men in civil service situations here in New York also get time off after the baby's born?
Yeah, but that's
separate. Dude, Ed.
I can understand a federal law.
Yeah, pregnancy is not an injury. It's not
the same thing.
It's not comparable. Pregnancy is a woman giving birth to a child. It's not some sort of injury. And, you know, the compensation should be different. And if women get injured, they get the same compensation as men.
Yeah.
There you go.
I would think.
That's hilarious. It's like these women, they get the babies in them, and who put them there? They expect to, you know, have this time off. Yeah.
Yeah, that is the mentality.
Yeah, this is exact mentality of Michael Burke. It's insane. So, look, we're going to come back. We got Dick Cavett. We got Chappelle DVDs to give away. We got Michael McKean, Bob Balaban. Hell of a show.
Yeah.
It's 57 past the hour. Hope you're having a decent morning. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Blah, blah, blah.
6 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's Wednesday morning. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. How are you? We got Dick Cavett coming up in a little while. He's releasing some old episodes of his show. There's a Rock Icons edition coming out, which I watched a couple of, him interviewing David Bowie, Sly Stone, David Crosby and Stephen Stills and the Jefferson Airplane. You know, TV was so different. It's going to be interesting to talk to him about that in just a few minutes. We're going to be talking to Cindy Sheehan hopefully a little later in the show in just a few minutes. We're going to be giving away some stuff, giving away some Dave Chappelle DVDs. They have his new, this is the unedited Showtime special, Dave Chappelle's For What It's Worth. So get ready to answer a little Dave Chappelle trivia. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Researchers in the U.S. plan to grow meat in a laboratory. Consumers say if they want to eat unnatural and unidentifiable substances, they'll stick with Chicken McNuggets. Officials at Oscar Mayer say that they are doubtful if science can ever duplicate their unique blend of hooves, lips, and anuses. Airlines are being forced to remove life vests from airplanes because of the increasing weight of American passengers. In order to make up for the lack of life vests, passengers are now told that their chubby seatmates can be used as a flotation device. The FAA has increased... Grab on! The FAA has increased the estimates of passenger weights by 8% for males and by 18% for females. The larger increase for women is due to what statisticians call the Kirstie Alley effect. BBC newsman Michael Bjork claimed that the world is run, quote, according to women's rules, unquote. Bjork claims that men are becoming more like women, a comment which caused many men to go into crying jags and threaten to withhold sex. Those are your morning tradition clip notes. Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, let's get into this. You know, speaking of that, you know, the mad cow thing. Man, the Agriculture Department said yesterday that over the 17 months, all right, dig this, from January 2004 through May 2005, inspectors found 1,036 violations of rules aimed at preventing mad cow disease from reaching humans. They were quick to add that no contaminated meat went to consumers. Meat packers, apparently, as you know, some of you, because I'm a little freaky about this, they're supposed to remove brains, spinal cords, and other nerve parts, which can carry mad cow disease, from all cows that are older than 30 months when they're slaughtered. But just because they remove this stuff doesn't mean that that we're completely protected. And this scares the hell out of me because this indicates some real problems in enforcing the rules. For example, there were mistakes in identifying animals' ages. And I'll tell you, with those two last reported cases of mad cow and all the chaos and cover-up around that, and mixing tissue samples, you know, not getting the brain in the right preservative. I mean, this stuff scares the hell out of me, Riley.
Well, you know, it's funny how they try and frame this. You know, the American Meat Institute Foundation says that this indicates a remarkable level of compliance with federal regulations. Now, the flip side of that is 1,036 violations could mean 1,036 cows with mad cow eventually ending up in the American food supply if this level of violations continues.
Well,
then how many people get sick?
Exactly. And you don't know if they're going to get sick for 10, 15 years from that Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease.
Yeah.
You don't know, and they don't even know what makes that up or how many it's really here or what. There's so many unknowns about this stuff, but it is clear that mad cow causes some real problems, and there are problems within the entire infrastructure and the entire production structure of the meat business.
Yeah, and the other thing is, you know, how much of this stuff they actually inspect is open to question as well.
Right, and here's some creepy gross news. How about some test tube meat? Researchers in the U.S. say that technology now exists to produce processed meat such as burgers and sausages, starting with cells taken from cows, chickens, pigs, fish, and other animals, right? This is the idea. You grow meat without the animal. And apparently they're saying that this is good. It's good for the environment. You're not killing as many animals, and there's not that methane and mad cow and everything else. Apparently the argument is cultured meat would be theoretically healthier than farm-raised meat. And this is like real, real sci-fi stuff. I mean, the process, I guess, is that you grow muscle cells on these large sheets or beads suspended in a growth medium. All right, and then once they get big enough, you just scrape them off and make them into a hamburger.
Hey, listen.
Oh, my God.
Whatever you do, do not relate this story to Sammy the Stem Cell, okay? Don't do it, because this is just, we may be talking about his cousins or relatives here.
But it's just like, I wonder, what the hell could that taste like? See, that's weird. I haven't eaten meat in a long time, so I'm sort of like, well, maybe that's a good alternative for me. All right, so let's do this Chappelle thing. It's giveaway time, my friend.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, here we go. We are giving away copies of Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special, Dave Chappelle for What It's Worth, on DVD. That's courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. All you have to do is call in to win, but there's a catch. We only want to give these out to Dave Chappelle fans. So we're playing clips from Chappelle's show, and you'll need to tell us what person Chappelle is impersonating in the clip. We started with a pretty easy one yesterday. Most people knew who this was.
Yes, they deserve to die, and I hope they burn in hell.
All right, that was, that was, of course, Sam Jackson. All right, here's today's clip, and when we open the phones, you can call in to win Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special on DVD. Are you ready? Here it is.
Pardon me, madam. Will this be reflected upon my frequent flyer miles?
Did you book your flight online?
Yeah!
All right, got that? On a scale from 1 to 10, it probably ranks a 3 in toughness. All right, let's play it one more time.
Pardon me, madam. Will this be reflected upon my frequent flyer miles?
Did you book your flight online?
Yeah! All right, all right. Who is Chappelle impersonating? The phones are now open. 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We're going to get a winner as Morning's Edition continues. We have Dick Cavett coming up. We've got Michael McKean and Bob Balaban. Cindy Sheehan will be on the phone a little later. It's a big show today, and yeah, it's just getting started, it feels like. It's 13 past the hour. It's Wednesday morning. It's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Morning, coffee, please.
You're listening to Morning's Edition.
It's all our fault.
Call us at 866-303-2270.
Yeah, whatever.
That's 866-303-2270.
It's gonna be fun.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Enjoy.
Seventeen past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We got Dick Cavett coming up in just a few minutes. Right now, we're in the middle of a giveaway. We're giving away Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime special. Dave Chappelle, for what it's worth, courtesy of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. We're trying to get you to identify a character from the Chappelle Show. Here's the clue.
Pardon me, madam. Will this be reflected upon my frequent flyer miles?
Did you book your flight online?
Not that tough for people who are hip to pop culture. We've got a lot of calls here. I think we've limited it down. Let's take Peter from Portland, Maine. Peter, what do you got?
It's Little John.
What?
Yeah!
What?
Yeah!
What?
Yeah!
Yeah!
All right, man. You got it, buddy. That DVD is yours. Stay on the line. We'll get your information. There you go. So we're going to do another giveaway in just a little while. As I said, Dick Cavett is coming up in just a few minutes. Let's get a little Cindy Sheehan update. She's moving the growing roadside encampment that is Camp Casey to a large tract of land closer to Bush's fake ranch because a neighbor of Bush's, Fred Matledge, offered the use of the property. Very nice gesture.
Yeah, and you know he's a distant cousin of the guy who fired off the shotgun.
Oh, kidding. That's hilarious.
That is ridiculous.
That is hilarious. The group of Bush, another group of Bush's neighbors, not the guy, maybe the guy who fired the shotgun as part of this, apparently appeared before the McLennan County Commission yesterday morning asking that a no parking zone be expanded near the fake ranch, which would force the protesters to move into Crawford, which is 7 miles from the Bush fake ranch, as opposed to 5, which is where they're at now. Neighbors apparently have complained about traffic jams and blocked roads, and this is one that kills me. They've expressed concerns about their children's safety because school started on Tuesday. Yeah, those damn hippies. They might just kidnap one of our kids.
Well, wait a minute. How many people signed this petition?
I have no idea, man.
60.
60?
60.
So that's not that many?
6-0.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be for North. You couldn't get on the ballot to run for dog catcher in New York
but
with
then
60.
But you got to figure how big is Crawford, really. But, it's interesting that this is what they're basing. This is a counter-protest. And the guy, the despicable idiot who drove his pickup truck over the white crosses that had been set up along the side of the road representing the Iraqi war dead Americans killed in Iraq, he plowed over him. He was arrested. And apparently the crosses were put back into place. And apparently, Cindy Sheehan said in relation to the locals wanting her to leave that, quote, they should talk to their neighbor George Bush and tell him to talk to us. End quote. So we're going to talk to her in just a little while, check in with what's going on out there. You know, these plane crashes make me nervous because I'm going to be traveling this weekend. That West Caribbean Airways, McDonnell Douglas MD-82 heading for Panama to Martinique, that reported engine problems, then crash killing 160 passengers all on board. And then there was that Greek flight a couple days ago. This just makes me nervous.
Yeah, it should make people nervous. And what's trouble? I mean, the island of Martinique must be in deep mourning. It's a small island to begin with.
It was a
chartered flight, and most of the people on it were Martinicans. So you're talking about a large number of folks who are grieving because most people either knew or had family on that flight.
Tremendous when a tragedy affects so many people in one community because the community is small. Like that. West Caribbean Airways is a Colombian airline that's been around since like 98. And apparently in March of this year, a twin-engine plane it operated crashed during takeoff, killing 8 of the 14 people on board. So I don't know how long they're going to be in business.
Not long. Apparently there was one small island that wouldn't let them either land or take off after this last accident because they're saying it's just they're too close.
And then that on that Cypriot air crash of the Helios Airways flight on Sunday that killed 121 people, that thing is getting so convoluted. I mean, apparently a couple of Greek F-16 fighter jets intercepted this plane, which had been flying on autopilot for a couple of hours. The assumption was that everyone on board had died because there was a decompression problem. But they say they saw a guy passed out, the co-pilot passed out in the cockpit, and that the pilot was not in the cockpit. They also said that they saw people trying to take control of the plane. They don't know if it was passengers or crew.
Yeah.
You know, and apparently some Cypriot police in Cyprus, they raided the Helios Airways office with a search warrant to secure documents and other evidence that could be used to investigate possible criminal acts. And the coroners haven't determined, you know, whether or not everyone was dead or what they have to do toxicological studies. And there's an aviation expert said that if it was a decompression problem, that these pilots are trained to drop to 12,000 feet so people can breathe. So there's a lot of mystery shrouding this thing.
Well, there's also the mystery of a former chief mechanic for Helios who said that the same plane, lost cabin pressure during a flight back in December, and it turned out the door wasn't properly sealed.
Huh. Yeah, so maybe that was that simple, but it just seems, when you read this story and there's all these loose ends and we're living in the world we're living in, I'll tell you, it makes me a little crazy. They haven't found the pilot yet. They found the body of the co-pilot. Not that he would have parachuted out, but it's just sort of shrouded in a certain amount of mystery. Maybe we'll get a little more information. I'll tell you what's not shrouded in mystery anymore is the killing of that Brazilian man in England after he was, after the suspected, the bombings that didn't go off. Shortly after that, they just blew the hell out of this guy.
The next morning.
Yeah. An official investigation into the killing of this guy from Brazil after the attempted bombing London reveals that the truth contradicts the police report. Evidence from video cameras proved that the police report was just completely fabricated. It was bunk. There was a shoot-to-kill policy, and this is what transpired. This is what happens when you're in a heightened level of fear and alertness, and you're given this ability to profile in the extreme. Is that the lie at the core of this was that he was a suspect, and the truth was that the police misidentified this guy.
They mistook him for Hussein Osman, the guy that they later arrested. And, you know, they literally just executed the guy. Criminal charges will be following this, Mark, unless I miss my guess.
Right, but all this stuff that we had heard, that he was wearing a bulky jacket, he wasn't. That he began running from officers and jumped over the turnstile.
No.
He didn't. That they pinned him down and shot him 5 times in the head. Worse, they shot him 7 times in the head, once in the shoulder, and missed a couple shots. They found casings on the floor.
One cop apparently had him, had his arms pinned, had wrapped his arms around him, and next thing you know, the cop seemed to think that the shot came out of nowhere. He said it was right by his left ear.
Yeah, it's horrendous to me because I was on Opie and Anthony yesterday talking to these guys about, you know, racial profiling and the fact that it doesn't work. It's impossible to enforce. You can't be, you know, have everyone calling up with suspicious looking people because everybody's frightened. And then when cops are trigger happy or when they're, you know, in a heightened state of alert, this is what happens because a guy looks like a guy.
And trigger happy and then lied about it. That's the cops in this instance obviously concocted a complete fabrication of what happened to this young man, Jean-Charles de Menezes. And my guess is, A, the Brazilian government is going to start getting directly involved in this and start demanding some form of justice. You don't do this to a foreign national without having that national's government react to it.
And this, again, in discussion in terms of, you know, what do we do to secure ourselves? I had this conversation with Opie and Anthony as well, and we've had this conversation here about cameras and their criticism of the American Civil Liberties Union trying to say that this is an intrusion. You know, there needs to be some sort of space negotiated because it's odd that in a situation like this where you have the subway well videoed, you know, which I don't think is bad to have cameras in the subway to watch for crime in an enclosed area where these kind of things are probably, you know, could happen, whatever it is that it, despite the fact that it may intrude on people's privacy or that it may not be effective in catching criminals, it did catch these cops in the sense that there was no way for them to contradict the video images that this wasn't the guy and the actions that they took.
Yeah, and again, that is one of the byproducts of having that level of surveillance in train stations. And I think what you're going to see, Mark, is A, the British expand what is already a very large camera surveillance program throughout the city of London, certainly. And I think that you're going to see increased pressure on the part of the NYPD here in New York and perhaps other police agencies across the country where there are big mass transit systems, places like Boston, places like Philadelphia. They're going to start pressing for surveillance cameras of a similar type.
Well, I think that, you know, in terms of the conversation I had with those guys yesterday in terms of the ACLU, is that they need to fight for every constitutional right at all times because there needs to be an active debate at all times and someone needs to be defending them, the Constitution, no matter what, so you can meet a sort of middle ground. You know, it seems to me that a lot of the reason why the ACLU does what they do is to protect the future.
Yes.
And that is very important, the future of the Constitution and the future growth and life of real democracy, if we can get back to that.
Well, let's hope we can, because what happened to this guy cannot afford to be replicated anywhere else on Earth.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, we got Dick Cavett coming up in a few minutes, and I'll tell you, I watched some of these interviews that he did with David Bowie and Sly Stone, some of the most uncomfortable television I've ever witnessed, and I want to ask him whether he was as comfortable as I was, though it was very engaging. It was great TV. It's 27 past the hour. Dick Cavett coming up next. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Reilly on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Reilly.
Yep.
Sarah America Radio's Morning Sedition. Our guest in studio, I tell you, I was watching these DVDs of his old show, and there are moments on these shows, the Dick Cavett show, that remind me of Air America, because there was a cultural dialogue then that was a lot freer now. Here's a little quick clip from David Crosby.
Well, like the air that we're all breathing is not clean, right? You're aware of that, right? Everybody is. Anybody looks out the window. Consider this. The only way to solve it seems to be to convince GM, Ford, Chrysler, 76 Union, Shell, and Standard to go out of business.
All right.
Which is merely a setup for the punchline, which is fat chance.
Yeah. Especially since four of them are my sponsors.
Yes! Our guest was the host of ABC's The Dick Cavett Show from 1969 until early 1975. Welcome to the show, Dick Cavett. I'm glad you're here. That was a great exchange. That was quick, man.
Did I do 90-minute shows that many years?
You might have.
God, I used to be a tall, redheaded man.
Oh, wow.
I'll tell you, watching those shows was amazing to me because you were able to balance. You had musical personalities. You had political people. You had movie stars. And it created this, of course, long before Bill Maher ripped off the format of your show to just make it specifically about politics.
I must speak to
you. You like that.
Yeah, but it was incredible that you were able to manage that. And there was, in some situations, I noticed a lot of tension on the show. Did you feel that?
You know, tension was one of the many qualities that caused you to go home and throw up your dinner.
No, it was great television. Did you find that audiences were different then?
You know, I think they were. I think the shows were very different then, as some of the ways you've said. And the fact that now we accept the fact that some unknown actress is going to come on and show a clip from an unknown movie.
Yeah.
And use the word exciting six more times before she gets on. And then we bring somebody else on who plugs this or that. I had to actually check and be sure that I could produce shows with four guests, none of whom plugged anything.
That's true.
Like getting an award where you're obliged to thank everybody, including your proctologist. You say, "Oh, I've got quite a list here," and the music plays, and
thank you, Dr. Jones, for removing the polyps.
Yes, that's exactly.
I always like the ones where you have hip hop artists who curse all through their albums, and the first thing, the first people they thank God.
Thank God. Yeah, I get irritated at that. I get irritated at the basketball star who comes off and gets the mic and he wants to thank his Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And I always want to say, don't you think it's a little egotistical to think that God looked at this game and decided you should win, not the other people?
The one thing I was noticing when I was watching your shows, you know, these were the Rock Icon shows that are going to be released on DVD this month. they're great because
I think they just were.
Yeah. So within the last couple of weeks, is that you had Sly Stone on, you have David Bowie on, and these were musical personalities that were really not accustomed like today on MTV to talking. You know, in public.
And they weren't big on verbal.
Exactly. And there was a moment where you're talking to Sly Stone.
Oh, God.
I didn't know where that show was going. What was going on?
Believe me, I didn't either. I thought somebody might come out and roll us both away in the opposite wings. I've heard about that 1,000 times since. Some reason I didn't see the show that night when it aired.
You've seen it now, though.
But people give them so many Rashomon-like versions of what took place.
Yeah,
they'll say, "Oh, he really just cut you to pieces. How did that feel?" And they'd say, "You really had him going, but it was clear you didn't know what any two words he said in a row meant." And so I looked at it the other day.
Do you think he was high?
If I were writing a piece about it, say again.
Do you think he was high?
Honestly, I don't. I'm not sure he was, though. It seems like the odds might tilt in that favor. But
if you're writing a piece about it.
But if I were writing a learned piece about it, I would say that I'm not so sure that Sly wasn't totally in charge of that conversation.
That's interesting.
That he's probably a better media manipulator than Abbie Hoffman. Mm-hmm. And if you watch it, it plays almost like a nice scene from an Noel Coward comedy. There's a laugh every place is supposed to be. His timing is impeccable.
And the spaces.
And yet he was able to come off and convince everybody that he was a stoned geek.
That was the profound thing about that show. Is like when you're talking to him one-on-one, he kind of throws a couple questions at you, and there's a certain amount of discomfort and back and forth. And then when you have Debbie Reynolds sitting there, and then Fred Harris and his wife, Senator Fred Harris from Oklahoma, there's a point where Sly just goes, "I'm taking over now."
I think so. And he asked intelligent questions later on about things that were going on.
Exactly. We've got a little bit of that on. Why don't we play a little of that, Tim?
I hate to...
Mr. What do I call you, actually?
Just Mr. Mr.
Just, you like the way I do. I'm going to be put on.
No. Just whatever, you know, it doesn't matter, because it's only for means of identification. Whatever you say, man.
Well, but a person wants to be known by his name or something similar to it.
I can feel when you're talking to me. I don't care what you call me.
Wow. See, Cabot,
what a rogue.
Yeah, right? Now, you had a really wide variety of guests on this one. Did you get a lot of flack from the suits at ABC in terms of some of you saying, "Hey, look, Dick, you know, Janis Joplin, man."
Oh, I know. They were terrified when rock people came on.
And why?
They all seemed to do only my show, and I never knew why. I don't recall, actually, if Janis was the first big rock star that I had on and that she spread the word or what. Janis came on 3 or 4 times and was better each time, including the last where it was 2 weeks before her death.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they would get worried. And there was a man whose job was to, as the late Fred Allen would say, who came in and found a molehill on his desk each day, and his job was to build that molehill into a mountain before it. the Mr. Nervous Man came in, and it was the airplane that time.
Okay.
And he said, you're going to talk to these people, are you? I will talk
these people.
To them and hope they talk back. What are you going to say? I said, well, this isn't a scripted show. I hate to break the news to you, but often things are said on here that aren't planned ahead of time. And here are 4 or 5 subjects I'll probably bring up. And he grabbed that and looked at him. And said, do you have to do that? I said, I forgot. Is it true that they're going to burn a flag on the show? I said, well, if they do, I hope they do it safely because there's a lot of theater people. Anyway, he had finished all his things and satisfied himself, and he forgot to check the lyrics of their song.
Oh, wow.
That's why the country heard what sounded to most of them unknowing as, up against the wall. Up against the wall. That may not be the tune, but... I didn't notice it even. I was totally. Next day, somebody in the hall said, "Did someone on your show say?" only twice.
So, I got to ask you another question because it's kind of ironic. One of the people that you interviewed was Joni Mitchell, who was young at the time, and she sang Chelsea Morning.
Hey, we all were.
Yeah, I know, right? She sang Chelsea Morning, which is now turning up on Bill Clinton's CD compilation. Joni Mitchell's Chelsea
Bill Clinton's CD.
Bill Clinton has a CD that's coming out.
Yeah.
And on it is Chelsea Morning.
Performed by?
Joni Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the other thing about Joni is that she was, of course, billed for the big festival in the farm.
Woodstock.
By the way, yeah. And people said about that, you know, I've been looking this thing over. They're going to be lucky to get 500 people there. You know, it's a dismal old farm upstate New York. Was it 500,000 that came to Woodstock?
Yeah. 300,000, something like that.
Yeah. So it made it hard to get from there to my show planned for the very next night.
Right.
I think Hendrix was on stage till 8 a.m.
But he was supposed to come on the show. You were talking about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he was billed for the show, but he couldn't get out of bed, and who could blame him?
Yeah, they were all sort of laughing. Stephen Stills and Joni Mitchell and the Jefferson Airplane were all sort of like, yeah, he's sleeping.
His door is closed.
Exactly. That was a great show.
Well, it opened 2 days later, and then later he came on the show, and then came on again. Now, what's this? Mm-hmm. Last night, I'm leaving the apartment,
mm-hmm.
and I hear... Oh, God, who was it? Wolf Blitzer thing. And also the story about Jimi Hendrix's private life, the one that nobody knows until now, I guess. All that after this message, and I never heard it.
No, it's a new book said that he claimed to be gay to get out of the service.
Yeah.
That's the big news from that book.
It would seem to be a sign of sanity, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely a sign of sanity. Now,
otherwise,
interesting.
You'll find yourself clearing brush in Texas and fishing.
Okay. You're talking about unscripted, and I want to talk a little bit more about that, because I've done some shows where now segments are produced meticulously to the point where there's a pre-interview process where you watch a talk show, and almost nothing is unscripted. And if it is, there are moments of unscriptedness. There's like, oh, my God, did that just happen? But yours was really unscripted, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about that when we come back.
Why are you reading this off a card?
Because I can't do it without it, Dick. thank God I got a guy writing all this stuff for me. It's 44
minutes. Somebody's
going
to believe it.
We're on with Dick Cavett. He's going to stay with us, so why don't you as well? Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're sitting here with Dick Cavett. I actually have a Dick Cavett story that you probably don't remember. Yes, I'm in Montreal. I'm there for Comedy Central covering the comedy festival. I'm interviewing people, you know, outside. I'm sticking mics in people's faces. I interview you, and then Jonathan Winters walks up. And I'm about to interview Jonathan Winters, and you come up to me and go, "Wait, I love Jonathan Winters." And you went over to my sound guy, took his headphones off, and sat there while I was interviewing Jonathan Winters, laughing your ass off.
Oh, was that? I thought you were going to say I took your microphone, too.
No, you almost did, but you were such a Jonathan Winters fan that you, it was just so funny, because I'm sitting there and he's making a fool out of me like Jonathan can do, and you're sitting there laughing. It was great.
When Jonathan Winters hit, no one had ever seen anything like it. He wasn't in any tradition of comedy. He created a mad universe of his own, which was just unprecedented. And you can hurt yourself and laugh. When Jonathan was in his unfortunate manic phase, once he was on the Tonight Show with Parr, then they went to Hurley's Bar, and the associate producer said, "We laughed for 3 hours without stop." And then he finally had to go home to New Jersey to bed, this producer, John Carsey, and he said, "That morning I came back still thinking about how funny it had been the night before, and Jonathan was still there."
At the bar?
So the fatigue factor of his genius is really must be something to have endured all these years. Did you ever hear the Contraband Jonathan Winters tape?
No, I haven't.
I've lost mine again, but if I ever find it.
I'm sure one of our listeners can set us up with it. What I wanted to ask you about live television.
Yeah, sit there, Ma. This won't hurt you. Honey, what are you doing? So, I'll give you a hint.
Yeah, it's so weird. It's amazing how much Robin Williams stole from him. But the thing I want to talk to you about live television, about my feeling and watching your show and having been a guest on like Conan O'Brien and stuff like that, is that how much was it all unscripted, Dick? Was there, you had some questions, but they had no idea what they were going to be asked?
No, nobody knew. I didn't always know. Well, I started to reveal something the other day. Somebody asked me, I don't know how we got off track. I didn't ever see you looking at notes very much. Well, I had 20 over 5 vision, which is two categories better than 20/20, so I could read a newspaper that somebody had across the way in the subway or something. So I could put notes in very small type, and once or twice only, but, and I felt so guilty, I would say, your novel, The Bear, there was a line, I think it went something like, and I would read it. Nobody dreamed I was reading it because it was as far away from me as you are.
So you had a trick.
But I found it good to have notes, though sometimes I didn't, because at least you have the feeling there's something to go to if everything else.
Right. Well, I just love it. I love watching that kind of television because the one thing I notice about watching those shows, like the one with Debbie Reynolds, Sly Stone, Fred Harris, and Pancho Gonzalez, was that there was a great mixture of people, but there was also that feeling that you really realized that you were walking some sort of tightrope with these people, and it wasn't really, you weren't sure where it's going to go. And I think that today's television wants to guarantee that people do exactly what they expect them to do unless it's a reality show.
Yeah, I think it's prepackaged a lot.
Yes.
You can always spot that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's most of it.
Much fun. If you said tightrope or something like it just now, yes, that was part of the fun, is a sense of danger should be there.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
Two greatest advices I ever got were from Jack Parr, who said, don't ever think of it as an interview, kid. Think of it as a conversation. And I can't remember what the other one was. But it was equally important.
You'll get it.
Somebody said that, yes, a good talk show should have a sense of danger. Do these people know where they're going with this? Or are they going to step off the
I actually think you
ledge?
Just said that. You just said that a couple minutes ago.
Often it happened. Danger happened, like with Lester Maddox and other entertainers.
What happened with Lester Maddox?
Well, first, getting Lester Maddox was almost as hot a booking as getting John Lennon, which I also did. And Lester was the segregationist governor of Georgia. And at one point in the show, I said, oh, we may have been asking for trouble, speaking of mixtures. The cast of that night's show was Lester Maddox, Jim Brown, and Truman Capote. And Lester got off on the right foot by sitting down next to Jim Brown and saying, I thought you was a singer. He looked at it like, as someone said, as a duchess looks at a bed bug.
I got to ask you about a debate that you held in 1971 that's kind of eerie now going forward. This was between John Kerry and John O'Neill?
Oh, my God, yes, that surfaced.
Yeah, it did during the campaign.
And eBay, not eBay, C-SPAN, they're so similar looking, they played the hell out of it.
Yeah.
That was eerie, because among the sensations that come to mind seeing yourself 30 years ago, one is I look like hell.
I thought you looked good.
That was very strange, and definitely from another time. And I didn't know what to do but just let them go. Because
who do you think won at that time in 71?
I like to think that Kerry did. Because John, the other guy, as O'Neill. I used to refer to him, O'Neill is a courageous man. He gave his wife a kidney, whether she wanted it or not. No, I didn't say that. You can edit that out of the final.
Sure, bit, sure. But, you can edit live radio.
Live editing. Yeah. But they, I think Kerry probably did. Certainly with my audience, whatever that meant, Kerry did, because leftish sentiments tend to get a bigger hand than rightish sentiments on the show.
What?
Although one guest did both.
Who's that?
I was on with the great Betty Davis, who may have been our greatest film actress. When I see her, I think she. And she had a lot done to her to bring her on, and she said a great deal of mechanical work has gone into my looking this good tonight. But at some point, we got friends. She never did that sort of thing. I said, why? You don't like interviews. You don't do this. And she said, well, you're right. But you're a gentleman, Richard. And I said to myself, if I'm going to go on with anyone, I said, how'd you lose your virginity, Betty? Laugh that nearly didn't end. And she said, as it was ending, I'll tell you. Applause and laughter. I waited until I married, and it damn near killed me. And I don't recommend it. I think the kids today have a more realistic idea of sex than we ever did. Well, I waited until I married, got an ovation, and then the kids today are right. The opposite sentiment, got the same ovation from all the same people.
Yeah.
So it shows the power of a personality to influence.
Yeah, absolutely. Dick Cavett, it was great talking to you. The rock icons.
Oh, I got about three more hours.
I know. We'll put you in that room over there, and we'll just get it on tape. The three-set DVD was just released. It is available, mm-hmm. and it's very worthwhile. It's a whole different era, and it was one of the... It's an archetype of television talk shows, and it was a real pleasure having you here.
Well, I think it'll probably do well. An order poured in this morning.
Oh, good. Absolutely. We'll be back with the War on Brains and Cindy Sheehan after this. Stay with us. Six past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. I hope everybody's doing all right out there. Look, you know, we were just talking to Dick Cavett, and I think it's very interesting that, you know, his show is able to engage, you know, politicians, musicians, writers, actors, and actresses in a type of intimacy that you don't see much on television anymore. And this is interesting to me because on one of the episodes that are available on DVD, he had Senator Fred Harris from Oklahoma, a Democrat. This is in 1970, talking about what should be important to Americans on a moral level.
I think we have to recognize and try to get our government and politicians to recognize that issues such as peace and race and poverty are not political issues, they're moral issues, and they have to be responded to on that basis.
Yeah, so how did the moral issues become so polluted and jaded by the conservative right movement and the religious right movement? Right now, MoveOn.org is organizing candlelight vigils across the country tonight in support of the action being taken by Cindy Sheehan down in Crawford. Meanwhile, Cindy may be moving to a new location closer to Bush's doorstep. This is her 12th day camped out at the Bush fake ranch. Cindy's back on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
So someone got arrested for running those crosses over. Has there been any other repercussions around that?
No, I think he posted bail and is out.
Okay.
And I think we're definitely going to get a restraining order.
Oh, good on that guy. Now, what about these neighbors that went over to the McLennan County Commission yesterday trying to get a no parking zone instituted, trying to get you guys to be pushed into town? Did that fail?
I don't think it was solved yet, but even if it succeeds, it has to be a 30-day thing, so we'll be gone by the time it succeeds anyway.
Oh, that's good news.
Yeah, but they're also trying to do is that will quell any other further, protests like ours, that will stop other people from going to the ranch and demanding to speak to the president.
So what about that fellow that let you guys use his land to camp on? Did you guys make the move over there? Are you closer to the ranch now?
We're actually going to be moving within the next couple of days. We have a couple of issues that we have to resolve, and we will be moving the next couple of days, and it's really great.
Cindy Sheehan, talk about exactly what the steps were. I mean, how did this man contact you? What did he say?
A couple of people were at the Crawford Peace House, and he walks in and says, my name is Fred Matledge. My cousin was the one that shot off the shotgun at you on Sunday. And he said, I'm here to say that I believe that that was wrong, what he did. And I have land closer to the president's ranch, and you guys are welcome to use it.
That's great. That's a great gesture. Now, you know, it's, do you feel like the sort of the focus of your vigil there has become diluted by the media circus that's sort of starting to surround you?
I think you're right. I think it might be, and we're really pulling back on that, getting it more focused on the families and the soldiers who are here.
Mm-hmm.
Cindy Sheehan, do you think that the longer you stay, the more likely it is that the president will actually have to come meet with you?
Well, I'm staying until August 31st. So, you know, if you know, he is saying things like it would set a dangerous precedent, you know, and this is his home, and people can't come to his home and demand to meet with him and stuff like that. But, you know, you were talking about, you know, when does something that's moral become political?
Mm-hmm.
I was on a radio show earlier, and I said, you know, to me, this isn't about politics. This is about life and death and flesh and blood. You know, this is what's going on every day. And if it falls along party lines, that's not my fault, you know. And this man said, well, you made a political statement when you said that Iraq was no threat to the United States of America. I said, how can that be political? It's the truth.
Wow. And how did he respond?
He didn't respond.
He was baffled and confused.
He goes, well, that's a political statement. I said, it's the truth. And if the truth falls along party lines, too, I can't help that either.
So now, when you go on these shows, are you coming up against a lot? You know, it was interesting. I talked to a guy yesterday on a radio show. I did another radio show. I talked to a conservative, and he was actually upset that he couldn't take shots at you because you are who you are, and you did lose a son in the war. And I thought it was a beautiful thing. I just smiled.
You know, Cindy Sheehan, one of the byproducts of your activity is that it seems that it has gotten more soldiers' families, soldiers who have been killed in Iraq, and in some cases, soldiers who have been wounded in Iraq, their parents, their families, are starting to speak out a little bit more. Did you expect that to happen?
I didn't, but I'm thrilled that it's happening. You know, I'm thrilled that one of the parents, I guess the parents of one of the Marines that was killed the week before I started this, spoke out yesterday. And if this is giving people a voice, this is you know, they might have felt alone. They might have felt like they were the only ones that had a soldier killed that felt the same way, that their son died for no reason. You know, and now they're seeing that they have this voice. And you know, Gold Star Families for Peace, we've been around since January.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had slowly new members come in, but you know, it's hard to get the news out. It's hard to spread the word, and this has spread the word. And people, you know, not only people who have had loved ones killed or who have loved ones over there that want them to come home, Military Families Speak Out has been getting 5 to 10 new members an hour since I started this.
That's amazing. You
know, it is amazing, and people are saying, wow, there's other people who think the same way we do, and we have some place where we can go and we can be supported.
We actually got a report in yesterday that said a lot of local newspapers are starting to cover the anger and grief of parents who lost kids in the war, whereas before they weren't even covering their opinions.
That's just awesome, and that's a blessing, and that's another Camp Casey miracle.
It absolutely is. Now, look, you know, tonight, MoveOn.org is organizing candlelight vigils across the country in support of your action out there. How do you feel about that?
I think it's really amazing, and last time I heard there was almost 1,400, so there might be more by now. And not only that, but there's grassroots Camp Casey is springing up all over the country, too. People who can't come out here to Crawford, Texas are making their own Camp Caseys, and people who have been here and had to leave are, when they get home to their communities, they're opening their own Camp Caseys.
It's great.
You know, it's a movement that's bigger than me, and you know, it's going to keep on going. If he meets with me today and I go home tomorrow, or if we go home August 31st, this is a movement that is organic and it's growing, and there's really nothing we can do about it.
Absolutely. And these vigils bring you.
And it's turned into an amazing peace movement.
Yeah, and these vigils and these independent actions of you are really bringing the focus back to peace, away from politics, which is you know, out of your control. And
right.
I, you know, this is day 12, and you know, we'll check back in with you tomorrow. It's great talking to you, Cindy. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you, guys. We love you all.
Okay, thanks. Take care.
Bye.
That was Cindy Sheehan out there at Camp Casey, you know, just outside of Bush's ranch. Still holding up. She sounds great.
It's a phenomenon. I mean, it is. And see, the interesting thing to me, Mark, about this is that it's not a political phenomenon. It's a moral phenomenon.
Absolutely. We got the War on Brains coming up next, and we're also going to give away another Chappelle DVD. So hang out. 14 past the hour, Eric America, Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Eighteen past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. What a show it's been, my God.
Yeah.
Bob Balaban and Michael McKean in the wings. Going to be out here in a few minutes to talk about the new funny. I got some new funny coming out.
All right.
On, what is it, IFC,
baby.
IFC, new funny on IFC. Every week we bring you the latest news from the front lines of the four-year global war being waged by the Bush administration. Here with today's dispatch from the War on Brains is war correspondent Mort Milfington.
Dateline, Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, home of the National Mall, where every year thousands of confused Texans get pissed off because they can't find the Hickory Farms. The mall.
Yeah, Hickory Farms.
War. You all know it. Ugly, brutal, unforgiving, an irritating little card game that's pointless, requires no skill, and offers no foreseeable ending. And just like the sticky, miscreant little 8-year-old who habitually challenges his long-suffering opponent to a round of this crappy game, only to resort to cheating so he can once again claim victory over his lonely, weak-bladdered grandmother. So, too, is George W. Bush challenging the very fundamentals of science while gaining the admiration of tumbleweed enthusiasts everywhere. For this week, the White House strongly rebuked a recommendation that a special commission be set up to improve science education in our colleges and schools. That proposal came from the National Science Board, or as our president calls it, the National Science is boring. Boring.
Yeah.
One of the problems the commission wanted to tackle was how to encourage students to stay in science programs when their school boards keep telling them global warming is just God's way of saying men shouldn't touch each other's nard sacks.
Nards.
Nards.
Mall.
Hickory Farms.
Sex. The administration's main objection to the commission was that it wouldn't have anything new to say to make science education better. Make it better. Shouldn't we be worried about making it exist first? That the White House would rather rely on dated findings of a science education commission led years ago by Senator John Glenn? Shameful. That the only significant finding of John Glenn's commission was squirrel monkeys overwhelmingly prefer the taste of Tang over Bosco while burning up in the Earth's atmosphere? Ignominious. That I would invent that last item just to get a cheap laugh? Unsurprising. Yes, chronic school underfunding, the promotion of creationism, and a scientific legacy based on the personal observation that immediately following a cocaine bust, physical matter like your arrest record and mugshot can literally dematerialize into thin air are the ingredients of George W. Bush's education program, his Xanadu. But not to worry, you Panglossian jackanapes. Because if our ever-vacationing president gets his way, next year there won't even be a National Science Board. And then we won't ever have to hear about the horrible state of science education again. I, for one, can't wait, because I'll never be able to run for state ombudsman until my ferret smuggling convention disappears. And that's today's dispatch from the mall and... The War on Brains.
You know, Mort, that's who you are today, right, Mort?
Yeah. Right. I'm also a paid mystery shopper for Buffums.
Oh, okay. All right. No idea what that means. But I used to enjoy Hickory Farms because you'd go to the mall when you were a kid and they'd have the free samples. Remember, you could have a little piece of the salami or the cheese and you'd go ahead and just lift a little glass dome and have a little taste.
Right.
Remember?
That's the stuff they dropped on the floor in the morning.
Oh, did you used to work there?
work there. I live there.
Yeah. Did they serve blacks?
Yeah. Hickory Farms?
On plates.
Oh, now see.
Which is the one that they had some trouble with? Cracker Barrel? Is that the one that...
Well, it's all in the name, isn't it?
Yeah, I'll say. Yeah, I don't know if they did. So you're all right, Jim?
I'm fine.
I'm going to do a little giveaway. You want
to
hang out for that?
Oh, sure. I'd love to be here for that.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
You're very
good at raffles and giveaways.
From all my years of hosting at comedy clubs.
Hey, you know what,
hey, tip your waitresses. I didn't host much. Yeah.
I'm going to fix it one day.
I got some plan
for my man over
there. It's not hard to fix this guy.
I remember your favorite line. Tip your waitress. Over.
Oh, that's hilarious. Are you 54 now? How old are you?
I'm as old as Dick Cavett.
No, so it's nice that you guys you could share a few memories. And,
right.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, I'm not going to be mean to you today. You know why? Because I'm bigger than that, Jim. I'm bigger than that.
So and you went to therapy yesterday.
No, that's today. What day is today? Today's Wednesday? Tomorrow I go. But yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for trying to hurt me. I just absorbed that.
I'd go to therapy, too, if I could afford it.
Yeah? Yeah. Well, you can't get on your health plan?
What? We have a health plan?
Oh, so, yeah, you better talk to the suits down at 641 if you need therapy. You know what I mean? Do you need therapy? What would you do in therapy? I can't imagine that being interesting.
Okay, so
let's play a question. Here, I'll do it. I'll play the therapist. So now, did you?
Stop hurting me!
What was your relationship like with your father?
I never knew my father.
All right, this is really going.
It was kind of like the relationship I have with you.
Really, yes. Tremendous, stilted, uncomfortable, and kind of adversarial
and very creepy.
Okay, here we go. Here's a giveaway time. All right, earlier in the show,
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Earlier in the show. We get Peter from Maine called and won himself a copy of Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime Special, Dave Chappelle for What It's Worth on DVD, courtesy, Jim, of Sony Pictures Home Entertainment. He correctly guessed this.
Pardon me, madam. Will this be reflected upon my frequent flyer miles?
Did you book your flight online?
He knew that was Lil Jon. So, look, here's the next clip. And the first caller to get it right when we open the phones will win Dave Chappelle's Uncensored Showtime Special on DVD.
Yeah!
Ready? This one's a little harder. Who is Dave playing here?
M-A-R-S. Mars, bitches. That's where we are going. Mars. Red Rocks.
Yay, yay!
I got that. It's a little tougher. So let's play it again, Tim.
M-A-R-S, Mars, bitches. That's where we are going. Mars, Red Rocks.
Yay, yay.
Yay!
A little different. Okay, the phones are now open, 866-303-2270. That's 866-303-2270. We'll get a winner when we come back from the break. We're going to also have Michael McKean and Bob Balaban here, but we've got a few minutes left here, you know what I mean, to talk to Jim Earle or Mark Riley.
Where?
Or Tim the Librarian. We've got some free time here, man.
Oh, we got free time?
We do, buddy.
So, oh, wait a minute.
What?
You know what we should talk about?
What?
Table thing in Jersey.
Oh, yeah. I got to find it.
It's here. I got it. I know you got it.
This was a restaurant in New Jersey. Two diners on a date at a fancy Jersey Shore restaurant were furious when they saw the check, which listed their table as that of the Jew couple.
I guess they
probably should have known when they seated them, because they had one of those microphones and said, with the two Jews, table for two Jews. Yeah, apparently it was on his statement. Like, not only was it on the receipt of the credit card, but I guess he got it on his statement as well.
On his statement, yeah.
That's hilarious.
It's sick.
How else are you going to identify him? I wonder if they do it with other ethnic profiling. Is that the theme of the restaurant?
I don't know. You know, they talked to somebody that works there, apparently the manager of the restaurant. I said, well, this was just for identification purposes, although they could not answer what would happen if there was more than, two Jews in the restaurant.
But yeah, exactly. If it is New Jersey, they probably have a real problem with the really Jewy, the really Jewy table, or a table for the Hebe table. Oh, look at it. I can't keep going.
Oh, look. Go ahead, man.
I'm a Jew, as you know, and the most heinous, racial epithet, is that we call it, that I heard for Jews was quip tips. Yeah, that would be a reference to the circumcision. Quip tips.
Oh, I thought you clip your tips that you give to the...
That's interesting. So you went with the other stereotype.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a
stereotype. What?
Do you get that money you owe me? All right, we got the Chappelle winner coming up next. 866-303-2270. Michael McKean, Bob Balaban. It's 27 past the hour, Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Ignatius is also insane, though.
Ignatius is really unusual, and that's...
No, he's insane.
Excuse me?
As director, there is never reason now not to take clothes off. When I have actor, actress come to me, say, what is seen, who am I, what I do, I say, sit down. I push on to you my sex. And then we make better movies. I have sex with all of the people first.
That is from Hopeless Pictures, a new animated TV show premiering this Friday on IFC TV as part of IFC's Film Fantastic Fridays. We're going to have the creators and writers and directors, Michael McKee and Bob Balaban, of that in just a few seconds. They're actually here now, but they're going to pretend like they're not until I introduce them. It's a beautiful thing about radio, see? All right, we're about to give away a Dave Chappelle DVD. Here was who you had to identify if you could figure out who this was from the Chappelle Show.
M-A-R-S, Mars, bitches. That's where we are going. Mars, Red Rocks.
Yay, yay.
All right. So, Steve, in Virginia, you got an answer?
Yeah. It's the Black George Bush.
Yay!
All right. Good, man. Yeah, good. Congratulations, Steve. You just won yourself a copy of Dave Chappelle's For What It's Worth. Stay on the line and give your information to Brendan P.W. McDonald. We'll get that right out to you. That's from Sony Pictures. They've given us all that stuff. Very nice. Sony Entertainment release. So now let's talk to our guests. Our next guests are stars of cinema and the theater. They were both in the films Best in Show and A Mighty Wind. You'll remember one from Spinal Tap, the other from Midnight Cowboy, Waiting for Guffman, and as the head of NBC on Seinfeld. That's a good credit. Bob Balaban and Michael McKean are here.
Hey, Close Encounters. He
Close has, Encounters, right? Yeah. I don't know why we pulled the Midnight Cowboy one.
Because it was your film debut.
Yeah. I remember I was a huge fan of yours after Altered States. I became very aware of you. And then when I saw Midnight Cowboy on video, I'm like, oh, my God, it's Bob Balaban.
And look what he's doing.
He's the gay guy in the bathroom.
Oh, Lord.
Very exciting for my family. Mom, Dad, I'm in a movie. Go see. He's like, but you didn't tell
I'm us. In the lower part of the screen, actually.
Doing the lower part of the business.
Oh,
we had to go there. So, fellas, what is? Tell us about this new animated thing.
Well, it's for the IFC. It is on Friday nights at 10 o'clock. It is an improvised animated series about a movie studio in Hollywood called Hopeless Pictures, named for Michael McKean's character's parents, Hope and Les Wax.
I play Mel Wax, who is a man who deep down fancies himself a storyteller, a simple spinner of tales. And, of course, he's just looking for that desperate big summer hit to make everything all right again.
Is that based on something, somebody you know or somebody?
It's based on everybody I know.
So now, how do you improvise an animated show? You improvise the actual taping, and then you do the animation.
Yeah,
later,
we improvise, and there's a guy sketching madly next to us as it's happening. Yeah.
It would be really bad if we did it backwards.
Yeah. No, Bob gives us some guidelines, and we go, and we get some people like your Jennifer Coolidges and your Lisa Kudrows and
Martin Mull,
Marty Mull, and all kinds of incredibly strange people.
Yeah, we've had some great visitors actually playing themselves.
Yes.
Really?
Because, our fake people interact with occasionally Nora Ephron, Paul Weitz, the
real
fantastic
people.
Director.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, Rob Reiner is on the show.
And he plays a character.
But he does not play himself.
No, he plays a character. He plays my nemesis.
Who did the Russian voice?
That's John Michael Higgins. Who was my significant other in Best in Show?
Oh, that's right. He's great.
Brilliant, brilliant stage film actor.
Again, he went away when we did some of the episodes, but he was there for the pilot.
Yeah.
How many have you done so far?
There will be 9.
Oh, that's great. And those start on Friday.
Yeah.
On IFC, which is a channel I actually watch.
It's a great channel.
Yeah, it is. It is a great channel.
This is the perfect home for it because they don't censor anything, and they don't give anybody any notes about how to do things. They really take that whole independent idea sort of seriously.
It's amazing to me. You guys are part of this whole community of funny people that have known each other for years. How did you guys meet each other?
You had to go to NYU, I think.
was that what it was?
A lot of us did. Yeah. But I didn't know you at NYU.
No, but I was there.
I didn't meet Bob until about 10 years ago.
I was at NYU.
Really?
Who are you guys? Yeah, I did.
I was in the School of the Arts Village.
Oh, okay, School on 2nd Avenue.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, I was at Washington Square College. Haig Menugian, do you remember? You probably don't know him. He was the head of the movie department at that point.
One of the great names.
Marty Scorsese was dedicated something to
Laszlo Vorkapik is also a good
name. That's a very good name. Yeah. You were in the film and you were in the theater department?
I was just in the theater department,
I was just studying to be something.
You weren't sure what it was?
We were all just dodging the draft, basically, but... try to get an education along.
So. Are any of the cats that you usually do, I mean, cats, what year is it?
any cats and kittens. There's something about being a radio station. Just shadowing. Just want to talk to the cats. Hey, we're going to have those submarine race watches tonight. You want to Murray the K in a swinging soiree.
Channeling Lord Buckley. Hey, cats and kitties. So now, how many of the people that are usually involved with the films that you guys do are on this show that you're doing for IFC?
Six.
Just six of you?
No, I'm kidding. I have no idea.
Coolidge, me, Coolidge, you, Higgins.
Eugene Levy?
Who else? I think that's it. And people come and go, so, could be other... Oh, Deb Thaker did some stuff. Which won't be on this round, but eventually will.
Deb Thaker is a very funny woman. She was the tearful sibling in A Mighty Wind. She's extremely funny woman.
Yeah, she is funny.
I got to ask, Michael, how did you get the gig as Adrian Van Voorhees on the Jiminy Glick Show?
I don't know. Marty Short just called and said, you want to play harp on my new show? And I thought he meant blues harp, harmonica. And I said, sure, whatever. And so we just kind of talked about it, and we kind of designed this
strange, I always enjoyed that show.
I did. It's a lovely show. Very funny show.
Is there more of it?
There are 30 episodes altogether. And I hope they put them out on DVD.
Yeah, it would
be
wonderful.
It would be nice to see, yeah.
Then they'll live forever.
Forever.
Forever on digital technology.
Be nothing left except the roaches and, and the DVDs.
And Jiminy Glick.
And Joan Rivers' eyebrow.
I love that show. But, and would that there would be maybe some similarities with our thing here. And one of the things I think about that show, which is true of us, I think, there were times when you're just watching it and you go, oh, what are they doing? This isn't really like anything too much. And all of a sudden, people do things when they're left alone like that you just can't believe that happened. It becomes so funny. And unlike writing, I mean, truly, a lot of great writing is just as good as great improvisation. But to me, when improvisation gets inspired because it wasn't being pushed, it wasn't like a show where they had to put it on week after week, and they had to memorize the improvisation. Mm-hmm. But when it's left around like that, occasionally things happen that are so sublimely suited to whatever it is, who the people are and what they're doing. That's what we live for on these things.
Just those little moments or little riffs
or a scene or something. Mm-hmm.
And it's that kind of tightrope feeling when you see somebody slipping on out there.
It's great.
Just on the borderlines of reality, is where Mr. Fred Willard lives all the time, by the way.
Oh, he's a trip, man. Is he on the show as well?
Not that I remember.
He hasn't done one of these, but he is one of those guys. It's just,
We were talking about that with Dick Cavett earlier in this show, that, there was a time where television was a lot more improvised, and it had that almost a menacing feeling of you just didn't know what the hell was going to happen.
Yeah.
And they're afraid of that now.
Well, it's just not designed for that. TV is designed to, case in point, to go on and to sell your latest project,
mm-hmm.
as we're doing right now. But
this is radio, Michael.
Yeah, I know. I'm media. Okay.
To us, it's always TV.
But, there was a time. I mean, I remember the Dick Cavett show specifically, where it's like anything could happen. I remember Lester Maddox and Jimi Hendrix and, Truman Capote and Norman Mailer and just all kinds of stuff.
Dick Cavett said this morning, outside there, he said that George Harrison was a guest.
Yeah.
And he said he got out there and George Harrison said hello and stopped talking and they had an hour and a half to go.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember.
Is Dick Cavett still out there?
He's resting. I think he left.
Okay. What were you going to say, Michael?
No, I was just, I remember that show. I remember that show. And he really didn't feel like talking much. And Cavett would say something like, You know, well, I always liked you. I thought you were the wonderful guitar player. And you'd go,
well, fancy that.
Oh, my God.
He kept saying, fancy that. And that was all he would say.
Well, he said he got him going at one point because he said, you know, 2 weeks ago, Yoko Ono sat in that chair. And Harrison, he said, leapt up from the chair. He kind of got him. He woke up at that point a little.
What was some of the, did you ever have, in your mind, like in improvising, were there, what was like one of the best, most outrageous moments where you couldn't even stifle your laughter? Have that, anything like that?
Anytime Christopher Guest is quirky.
Yeah.
I mean,
quirky
that's very
in Waiting for Guffman. I was not in that film, but that's pretty hardcore stuff.
With me, it's Willard and Coolidge, I think. There's this look in Coolidge's eye that says, I am goddess. I am comedy goddess. Don't cross this line. Yes, she's a peculiar
woman. We did
a
live stage version of A Mighty Wind where Michael and the people who sing actually went on tour, and I got out and introduced them. And at one point, because there was a lot of changing and replugging of guitars, something I've never understood what's really happening. I think it's fake, and I think they're just pretending. Jennifer came out and said things to me on the stage in front of thousands of people, and what Michael just said, this thing in her, she channels something, and I never believed it was true until I saw her out there in front of people. This thing infects her, and it goes into her eye, and some monster, some good monster takes over her body, and it does things.
Now, which character was she in the film?
She was the strange lady with the strange accent who was working on the PR.
She's the publicist.
The publicist. Amber, she and
Amber Starr or something like that.
Yeah, she and Larry Miller were the two.
But all I know is she had five lines in the movie, and when she comes out at the concert that we did,
She's the rich wife and Best of Show. She's a genius.
Yes, that's right. No, she's fabulous.
There's something like my wife, Misha, is a huge fan of hers, and she does something like you're just in this other planet. She's got her own time zone.
That's what it is. Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Kind of like Vice President Dick Cheney.
In a different sense, yes. Yes.
That would be the evil sense.
That's the evil sense.
So now what have you guys got going besides this? Are you doing films?
Yeah, I'm acting in a couple of things, and I'm directing a movie in the fall that I'm looking forward to called Bernard and Doris. Susan Sarandon is going to be Doris Duke, and Ray Fiennes is her butler, Bernard Lafferty.
Great story.
And it's kind of a what-if thing that might have actually happened, but it's sort of their relationship during the last few years of her life.
Well, that sounds great. And you're also in the Truman Capote movie?
Yeah, I'm in something called Capote that's coming out in the fall, which I haven't seen, and I hear it's very good.
Phil Hoffman is great.
He's great at everything, but he's a great Truman.
Yeah. And how about you, Michael?
I am semi-retired. No, actually, Chris is doing a new movie. Chris Guest is doing a new movie October.
Uh-huh.
I've been doing a lot of theater. I did Hairspray last year, and which was great. And this Woody Allen play called Secondhand Memory. And I just got back. The Beard is all about Williamstown. I did a Tom Stoppard play in Williamstown called On the Razzle, which was enormous fun.
Wow, and, that must be fun.
It is. It's great.
I keep seeing these signs for Harvey Fierstein playing Tevye.
Oh,
I can't. Yeah. If I were a rich man. All right. Michael McKean and Bob Balaban, the new project that you can see starting this Friday, August 19th at 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern, is Hopeless Pictures, an animated TV show that was all improvised, and these are the funniest guys in the world, so it's got to be great. Thanks for coming down.
Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks, Mark and Mark.
It's 47 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition. We'll be back in a second.
Morning's Edition.
It's just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, we're gonna put this thing down. I can see the lights. I actually got an email that said, "Can't you come up with something different every day when coming in for landing?"
We just did. Bob Marley. This is one of my favorite songs.
I'll tell you, 52 past the hour. As I said, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning's Edition. But I get an email. It's weird. It's like you're a creative person. Maybe it's a hook. You know what I mean? Maybe it's supposed to be the same every day.
Yeah.
You know? Hey, people are nitpicky. I tell you, man. A little nitpicky. Folks, on Friday, we are going to be in Harlem at Amy Roof's. We'll have pro wrestler Mick Foley with us, comedian Mike B, and best-selling author Bret Easton Ellis. Have some free coffee, bunch of giveaways. It's Soul Food and Sedition, my friends, this Friday morning at Amy Roof's on 116th Street between 7th and Lenox Avenues. That's from 6 to 9 a.m., Mark Riley tells me, best, at least, top three salmon cakes in the city.
Absolutely.
I'm looking forward to that. So tomorrow, Dave Chappelle fans, we're going to give away some more of the Uncensored Showtime special on DVD. Thank you to Sony Entertainment. That's Dave Chappelle's For What It's Worth. So, you know, check back in for that. We'll give a couple away tomorrow. Cindy Sheehan has asked supporters to start candlelight vigils in their communities to support her and call for an end to the war. So Move On is teaming up with True Majority and Democracy for America to host vigils for Cindy Sheehan tonight. There are already 23 vigils scheduled in New York City alone.
Mm.
Go to moveon.org to find out where one is near you. Dig this. What am I? I'm like a 1970s guy. 60s, 50s, dig. Where is it with digs? 23 Skidoo. Researchers at MIT are developing software for cell phones that would analyze speech patterns and voice tones to rate people on a scale of 0 to 100% on how engaged they are in conversation. The program uses mathematical algorithms to measure levels of stress or empathy in human voice patterns. The creators of the technology said it could be used to improve relationships. Now, I got to tell you something. If you can't tell when your significant other isn't listening, then you probably shouldn't be in the relationship to begin with. And
you
also, you've got to see. I don't like stuff like this because it's cheating. You know, I've got it figured out to where I can look at my wife and seem like I'm listening and I'm not. And you know, you don't want to be caught on that. I mean, that's one of the little tricks that give us a little free zone in the head sometimes.
Well, yeah, it does. And I'm constantly being accused of, you know, listening to my wife talk while doing something else at the same time, and this would ruin everything.
Yeah, well, that's it. You don't want to get caught with that stuff. And I can tell. I get very frustrated with my wife. The worst thing on the phone is if someone's online, because you completely know when someone's working on the computer. And I guess this would be good, on some level. Apparently, if someone isn't listening to you or they're not listening, something will come up in the. They're calling it the jerkometer. All right, and it sounds like it's something that's going to be marketed to kids.
Yeah.
So apparently, if they're not listening, a little text will come up in the window of your cell phone. It'll say, "Be a little nicer now," or "Don't be a jerk." You know,
don't be a jerk.
This is actually. It looks like it's primarily for the person talking, as opposed to the person listening. I guess it's going to go both ways. But the interesting thing is, we're now taking orders from our cell phone. At what point, you know, are we just going to surrender our consciousness and our behavior completely to machines?
What happens if both parties have one of these things and they both find out neither one is paying attention?
That's called marriage. that is called a mature relationship, right?
Yeah, there you go.
I don't, that's not really true. I am completely engaged at all times with my wife when she's talking. I find her riveting, even when she's just telling me what she did today or what she's planning to do.
Uh-oh.
See, it's towards the end of the show. There's an outside chance she might be listening. So for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. Researchers in the U.S. plan to grow meat in a laboratory. Just so you know, regardless of what happens, Ted Nugent's going to keep killing stuff. Airlines are being forced to remove life vests from airplanes because of the increasing weight of American passengers. In addition, Star Jones is suing one airline because they refused to serve her four special meals she ordered. That's a fat Star Jones joke. Right, BBC newsman Michael Bjork claimed that the world is run, quote, according to a woman's rules. Critics dismissed Bjork's remarks, saying he just had his panties in a wad. This is, of course, absurd. Women don't run my life, and I feel safe saying that because my wife doesn't get up early enough to hear the show. Except for now. Now there's going to be trouble. If that caused me trouble, I'd be in big trouble. Yeah, it takes a while for me to get in trouble. Anyways, today's phrase, just drop this into a conversation. Meat from a test tube. Wake up, sheeple. That way you can cook it up in a spoon and shoot it directly into your arteries.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, old school. That's the Morning's Edition Cliff Notes for today.
We had a big, big show today.
We got a big show tomorrow, dude.
Yeah,
Natasha
man.
Richardson, the actress, is coming in. How do you like that?
Yep, and of course, we're going to be talking again to Cindy Sheehan. And this is the big part, an all-new Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
I might have to shave for tomorrow's show. Natasha
wow, I
Richardson.
Did yesterday.
Yeah, you look good, man. You getting a haircut today?
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Good job.
All right, man. It's been a lot of fun. Join us tomorrow here on Air America Radio.